I'll try Major Audrey Yarn, the Academy's executive secretary. The Major has been here since 1938, and she remembers everything and everybody. Captain Lighthouse kept me on hold for 10 minutes. The line clicked. An authoritative female voice said, "Major Arndt here, Mr. Dunstan. Please explain your interest in Pledge Fletcher." I repeated my story. "Unwittingly, I assume, Mr. Dunstan, you refer to the single unhappiest incident in the history of the Fortress Academy. Artillery Pledge Fletcher died as the result of an assault by an intruder shortly before the Christmas break of 1941. His assailant was never identified. I would prefer that you make no mention of Artillery Pledge Fletcher's death in your article." Major Arndt, nothing in my piece requires me to dig up a 50-year-old scandal. There is one more favor I'd like to ask. If you would consent to fax me the 1939 to 1941 class lists from the alumni directory, I can take it from there. Nothing I might hear about the circumstances of Fletcher's demise will appear in the article. I'm only interested in the fate of the book. You are going to squander a great deal of time, Mr. Dunstan. Here at the Echo, Major, we practically eat time. Later that day, after Toby Kraft's funeral, when I reached Cherry Street, the ants were bustling back and forth in front of the stove. Splendid in a canary-yellow sports jacket, Clark looked up from the table. "Look here, boy. I got a new coat to celebrate your birthday." Aunt Nettie sang out, "Happy birthday," and bust my cheek. May said, "Stay right there. I'll get your present." "Old Toby's funeral is a lonely business, I reckon," said Clark. "No, a lot of people turned up. Some of them spoke about how much you love Queenie." "You can't take that away from him," said Aunt Nettie. "From the moment Toby Kraft laid eyes on my sister, he was a man under a spell." Aunt May returned and pulled from a plastic bag a pink sports jacket randomly imprinted with golf bags, golf clubs, and greens with flags jutting from the cups. I shrugged off my blazer and got into May's pink extravaganza. It was exactly my size. "And there's another treat," said Aunt Nettie. "Sweet potato pie." "We deserve a feast after all our sorrows," Clark said. "Is there any progress on bringing Toby's murderer to justice?" "I don't think so." "Jack the Ripper is running around Edgerton, but the police won't admit it." Through the kitchen window, I looked out at the paper tablecloth and jugs of Kool-Aid and iced tea on the old picnic table. "Too bad Joy can't be here," I said. "Joy wouldn't talk to me this morning," May said. "I wouldn't be surprised if she has had second thoughts about putting Clarence in that home. Are we ready to start the festivities?" On the other side of the picnic table, Clark made the most of a single black-eyed pea. A familiar sensation, that of steady electrical pulsations, flowed into my arms, and the colors around me blazed. I could not be sure how much time was left me. Robert lingered somewhere close by, burning with jealousy. "This is a wonderful birthday party, but I should go inside and lie down for a while." The buzzing pulse quieted in my veins, so I said, "At Toby's funeral, someone made a comment that made me think Stuart Hatch owned these houses. I always thought they belonged to you." Aunt Nettie patted my hand. "Son, you don't have to worry about us." "Which means, I suppose, that he does own your houses." "Over the years, our family has done a lot of business with the Hatches. At a time when money was running low, Mr. Hatch became aware of our difficulties, and he stepped in to do us some good."
"What kind of good?"
"Mr. Hatch plans to develop this area. In the meantime, we can stay here for the rest of our lives. Toby's money is what I call the icing on the cake."
Clark said,
"Speaking of dessert, where's that sweet potato pie?" "You'll wait until the boy's had his fit," said Aunt Nettie. "It isn't your birthday."
I walked through the kitchen, feeling Robert's hovering presence with every step.
"Show yourself, Robert." I came into the living room. "Did you know Stuart owned their houses?"
Trotting up the stairs, I moved over the landing and shuddered to a halt.
Howard Dunstan regarded me with dispassionate curiosity from the end of the hallway.
"Go outside, give your daughters a thrill," I said. "I'm sick of the sight of you."
He turned aside, inclined his head to the window behind him, and faded from view. I went to the window and looked down. Four people in festive spirits sat at the picnic table. Robert spoke to Aunt Nettie and made her dimple with pleasure. He looked astonishingly handsome. I moved from the window and saw the door to Aunt Nettie and Clark's bedroom. It was half open. Scarcely believing what I was doing, I went into their room. On the shelf above the closet rail, a manila folder lay an inch back from the edge. The folder contained a lot of black-and-white photographs. I took out some of the photographs and knew that whoever these people might have been, they were not Dunstan's. I found one of a small boy with bangs like his mother's, perched on a photographer's stool in front of a backdrop depicting an Italian hill town. His face was nearly identical to that of the 3-year-old Ned Dunstan in the photograph my mother had given me. I walked out of the bedroom to find Robert leaning against the wall, smiling at me. "Aunt Nettie and Aunt May are a perfect pair of rogues, and I can't say enough about Clark." Robert looked at the folder. "Is that what I think it is?" I pushed it toward him. "Take this to the car. I have to get back to the Brazen Head before my attack." Robert took the folder and disappeared. When I came out into the backyard, Clark and the aunts looked at me with gratified surprise. "Bounce back better than a rubber ball, that's what you do," Aunt Nettie said. "It's still on the way. I should get back to my hotel, but thank you for my birthday party. And I love my new jacket, Aunt May." I faded with none of Robert's impressive immediacy. Sprawled across the back seat, Robert said, "What do you make of these pictures?" "You first." He put on a mock professorial voice.
"These photographs represent approximately 15 years in the life of an increasingly well-off Midwestern family. We begin with a clever roughneck and a little beauty who had the misfortune of marrying him. They have two sons, 7 or 8 years apart, who are sent to a horrible school established to reinforce the fantasy that they are landed aristocracy."
"Anything else?"
"The first son looks like us," Robert said.
"He also looks a lot like Howard Dunstan," I said. Robert waited, and I continued. "The roughneck was Carpenter Hatch. The girl who turned into a phantom was called Ellie, short for Ellen, as in Ellen Dale. Their first son wound up in jail, disappeared, and supposedly died. Their second son, Cobden, went to work for his father, got married, and had a son. All his life, Cobden Hatch was afraid his son, Stuart, might turn out like his brother."
"Who happened to resemble Howard Dunstan," Robert added. "And when he was supposed to be dead, this cuckoo in the nest came back to Edgerton, calling himself Edward Reinhardt."
"He came back a second time as Earl Sawyer," I said. "Our father." Robert laughed.
"It means Edward Reinhardt was a Dunstan, and you and I are Hatches. Good old Dad ties the two families together, and what's the physical proof? Ned Dunstan. No wonder Stuart grabbed our photographs and wanted you run out of town. You could ruin his family's reputation. It's delicious. Reinhardt worked for his nephew Stuart for 15 years, and Stuart never recognized him."
I swerved into a parking place on Word Street. "Go to my room, Ma. I'll be right there." Robert disappeared from the back seat. I sped through the bursting sounds and blooming colors in the lanes and charged across Veal Yard. At the Brazen Head's reception desk, the day clerk said, "We have a fax for you, Mr. Dunstan." I went to the stairs, reading the brilliant black lines of the fax that Major Audrey Arndt was pleased to supply. I read down names listed under the years from 1938 to 1942. The fifth name down in the class of 1941 was Cordwainer C. Hatch. Robert was standing near the window when I came in.
"You got a fax?"
"Cordwainer Hatch, Cobden's brother. I think he killed a student at a military school to get his hands on the book I stole from Buxton Place." Blue light flashed to the periphery of my vision. "You know what we have to do, Robert." I moved toward him. In the second before I reached for him, I took the copy of the Dunwich Horror from the table and rammed it into a pocket of the pink jacket. Everything crashed and boomed. I fastened my hand on Robert's, knowing exactly what we were about to see.
Oh, you swarming cruelties, who giveth with one hand and taketh away with the other, I begin to see, with a bitterness I only now begin to comprehend. Last night, in darkness, my madness soared before the evidence of great destruction. I stood as if you knew not, amidst the ashes, as smoke from the cannon's mouth sent rage streaming forth and then devoured the substance molten, which is time, and shuttled back, godly and engorged, to where I shall once again slay Michael Anscombe and Sally Anscombe, and then, in triumph, destroy the twin antagonists. I set down the pen and closed the book. The triumph hastens, my heartless fathers.
A half second before we were to be delivered to Boulder, Colorado, I was united with my shadow again. Within this symbiosis remained a Robert and a Ned. Surprisingly to both, it seemed that Ned was in charge of the decisions. In the year 1967, we stood on the Anscombe's front lawn. The moon hung like a monstrous button over a ridge of mountains. Blue fire shone from a window in a new addition at the far left of the house. The Mr. X of 1967 was prowling in search of his son. A shaft of blue light, sent as a flag of ironic welcome by our Mr. X, Cordwainer Hatch, flared through a crack in the living room curtains. On the steps of the attic, our 9-year-old selves were meeting for the first time. A well-known pressure moved us to the front door. Mrs. Anscombe patted into her husband's blood. Unable to see the 35-year-old man who had materialized near the front door, 9-year-old Robert was watching her from the kitchen. As if following the direction of my thoughts, Mrs. Anscombe looked toward him and walked deeper into the red pool.
"Why are you doing this?" she shouted. "Don't you understand? I'm already in hell!"
"Don't worry, Mrs. Anscombe," said Cordwainer Hatch. "You will be taken care of soon enough."
She took another dazed step toward the kitchen.
"Shit! I really am in hell!" she shouted. "Only the son of a bitch isn't red. It's blue!"
The black death of the Hatchtown Lanes drifted toward us. A sickening wave of almost limitless rage streamed from him as his mind reached out to engulf mine and Robert's. The air gathered into a solid substance, pushed us back through yielding walls, and deposited us in a small room stacked with cardboard boxes. Cordwainer was only inches away. He stank of river bottom. Blue light filtered in from the living room, where the Mr. X of 1967 berated Mrs. Anscombe. Our Mr. X blasted a roar of outrage into our minds.
"You destructive, destructive, destructive little vandal! You monster!"
He drew a knife from his coat. A furious bellow and a series of muffled noises reported the demise of Mrs. Anscombe. Mr. X's younger self uttered a screech of frustration, thundered into the kitchen, and transported himself outside in pursuit of a small boy he knew had escaped him yet again. "I guess you're angry about the books," I said. Cordwainer grabbed our shoulders, spun us around, and clamped us to his chest. He dug his knife into our neck.
"Is this what you had in mind?" Robert asked me. "Sorry, but I'm not hanging around to get killed."
I told him to calm down. Cordwainer nudged the blade another eighth of an inch into our neck.
"You could say that, yes. I am angry about the books. Satisfy my curiosity. Where did you learn the name Edward Reinhardt? Was it your mother? That old fool, Toby Kraft?"
"Lots of people told me about Edward Reinhardt."
"Where are we?"
He sniggered.
"Don't you remember the Anscombes? Does Boulder, Colorado ring a bell? We have journeyed back through time, the substance molten, a matter undoubtedly beyond your comprehension, that I might inquire how you managed to get away from me that time."
"Why aren't you doing anything?" Robert yelled. "Are we just going to talk to a guy who's sticking a knife in our neck?"
"Shut up and let me handle this," I said to Robert. "We have to talk to him."
To Cordwainer, I said, "I can tell you who you really are. You'll find that tremendously interesting, I promise. It surprised me, too." A great wind whipped into the room, flattening the pink jacket against our chest. The window behind me exploded.
Are you looking for someone? I asked Cordwainer.
You destroyed my books. This is an outrage. Where is he?
I want to show you something, Mr. Sawyer. People are going to be able to see us. If you have any sense, you'll take the knife out of my neck.
I'll humor you.
The knife came out of our neck and jabbed into our lower back.
Robert asked,
What the hell are you doing now?
I told him to hope for the best, and all three of us dropped to the floor in a suddenly malleable time. I was aiming for something I wasn't sure I could find. The world ceased to swim. We were standing on a beaten footpath. Horse-drawn wagons and old-fashioned automobiles rolled past in both directions. Robert was shouting that he did not understand what was happening, and Cordwainer was jabbing a knife into our back. To our left, Howard Dunstan's mad, bearded face scowled through the windscreen of a high-top car, chugging toward us down wagon road. His wife languished beside him. Two pretty young women, who must have been Queenie and Aunt Nettie, became visible behind them. Just entering their teens, May and Joy peeked out from the rumble seat. On the far side of Wagon Road, a vehicle sleeker and more expensive than Howard Dunstan's floated into view. Carpenter Hatch muttered a remark that made the already wilting Ellie sink away. Through the rear passenger window of their automobile peered a sulky replica of myself and Robert at the age of 5. May Dunstan fixed her eyes upon the sullen, childish face in the passing car. A moment after the two cars separated, Wagon Road turned into chaos. Every windscreen and headlight within 50 yards exploded into flying glass. Panicked horses reared, bolted forward. I saw a horse go down and vanish beneath wreckage, its toothpick legs sawing the air. The pressure from Cordwainer's arm lessened, and the knife fell away. Robert and I had colonized Cordwainer's mind and memory. A bluebird tumbled to the floor of the ruin on New Providence Road. The Dunwich Horror leaped from the extended hand of a uniformed boy. Something irrevocably damaged flew through the Hatchtown lanes. And that something was Cordwainer Hatch. Robert shouted,
Kill him! Kill him! What's wrong with you?
I took the knife from Cordwainer's hand. Cordwainer looked at his empty hand and stumbled back, laughing.
Do you think I need a knife? Without your brother, you're nothing!
He surged over the grass. When Cordwainer slammed into me, I twisted sideways to absorb the shock and wrapped my arms around him. The three of us fell through a sudden trap door at the side of the beaten path. Still in the momentum of his assault, Cordwainer Hatch rolled from my grip and struck the table in my room at the Brazen Head. He groaned. The ghost of Edward Reinhardt shone in his ruined face.
Kill him!
Robert urged.
He's confused! He doesn't understand what happened!
It's going to get a lot worse for him, I told Robert. Just wait. The worst moments of his entire life are about to happen. At that moment, I felt very much like Robert. I said to Cordwainer, Why don't you begin by telling me about the house on the edge of Johnson's Woods? Cordwainer's face twisted into a smug, ghastly smile.
You wouldn't understand. You couldn't.
Then I'll give you some information you probably don't know. Carpenter Hatch bought that property from Howard Dunstan's daughters. It was where Howard spent his whole life, and when it burned down, he died in a fire. Cordwainer decided to humor me.
Really? This is completely absurd. The man I thought of as my father bought that land to build houses for what he called the Rising Scum. The Dunstans never had any connection to the property. They swarmed into Cherry Street like roaches, and they never left. That house was the residence of a god.
Howard Dunstan was a sort of elder god. That's what is so interesting about what he did to you. I took the photograph of Howard in his wing collar and high-buttoned waistcoat from the folder and slid it toward him. You're looking at Howard Dunstan, your real father. I moved a photograph of Carpenter Hatch alongside the first.
Which of these men would you say was your biological father?
Cordwainer barely glanced at the photographs.
I don't expect you to understand this, but my true fathers were not of this earth.
Let me tell you about your half-sister, May Dunstan. May caused that scene on Wagon Road. The instant she saw you, she knew you were Howard's son. Whatever abilities you and I have, we inherited from Howard Dunstan. his mouth tucked in at the corners.
What was my mistake? Calling myself Earl Sawyer? I didn't think anyone would catch that.
I almost missed it.
I'm not saying you're right, but it will explain a great deal about my childhood. My mother must have been more adventurous than I ever imagined, and it would explain where my looks came from. But the identity of my earthly parents, really, that's all the same to me.
Howard Dunstan manipulated you. He led you into the woods and brought you to what was left of his house. He showed you things. He made sure you came across a certain book and primed you with fantasies about H.P. Lovecraft. All along, he was just amusing himself. It was a game. Cordwainer glanced at the photographs again.
All nature spoke. The old one spoke.
Haven't you ever had doubts? Weren't there times when you realized that everything you believed came from short stories written by a man who never pretended they were anything but fiction? Cordwainer spoke with undeniable dignity.
I have had my doubts. I have known the dark night of the soul.
What happened to a Fortress Academy pledge named W. Wilson Fletcher? Cordwainer eyed us.
Busy little bee, aren't you?
I pulled the Dunwich Horror from my pocket. Cordwainer's eyes fastened on the cover. A bolt of feeling ran through his stolid face.
You stole that book from me, and I demand its return. You have no idea of its meaning.
I'll give it back after we visit Howard Dunstan. He's been waiting for us. I set the book down. When Cordwainer lunged across the table, I wrapped my fingers around his wrist. Resistlessly, we fell into the dense, darkly teeming world of a forest at night. I'd hoped it was late evening, June 25th, 1935. Cordwainer clamped an arm around our neck and cut off our air. As my eyes adjusted, the trees separated from the darkness and became a series of stationary columns daubed by moonlight. Before us stood a big maple I had seen before, though not in my waking life. I made a croaking sound, and Cordwainer eased the pressure on our neck.
You had something to say, little Robert?
Johnson's Wood. The house is up ahead, about 30 yards to the right, I said. A wave of river bottom vapor floated from his pores, his bald head, his mouth.
How much longer are you going to keep up this pretense? Are you ready to listen to the truth? I reject the idea that you are capable of moving through time, Cordwainer said. It was I who took us back to Wagon Road.
Then who brought us here?
I have no doubt of your ability to move through space. That you inherited from me.
We moved through the last of the oaks. Look to your right. In about 10 seconds you'll see a lighted window. Cordwainer chuckled at my attempts to hoodwink him. 2 steps later, a yellow glow shone through the trees. Cordwainer stopped moving. He strode into the meadow. He was staring at the portico, the facade slanting across the edge of the forest, the chimneys rearing against the sky.
What house is this?
Move closer, I said.
He can't hear us, and he can't see anything but his own reflection.
Cordwainer took a couple of paces. Unwelcome recognition had begun to blossom in his face.
That front window is like the very one I crawled through as an ignorant boy. I see your shabby plan. You have brought me to its likeness. Within walls like those, my great father spoke to me. That building was my school. And your teacher was Howard Dunstan.
He's in the big room on this side. Go on, look in the window. Think of it as a test of your faith. We came to within 10 feet of the shining window. Across the shabby room, an expiring Boston fern and a fox strutting to the edge of a glass bell occupied a white mantle. A brass clock that reported the hour as 11:31 p.m.
If anyone is there, Cordwainer said, let him show his face.
On cue, Howard Dunstan strolled into sight, his face ravaged. He was speaking with the slow, unstoppable rhythm of a hypnotist. I knew who stood just out of sight. Cordwainer Hatch unwillingly moved forward. Howard mouthed,
we all flew from the crack in the golden bowl.
Beside me, Cordwainer gasped. He took a quick backward step and dove into the woods with surprising speed. He stopped running when he reached the maple grove.
Still think it's some kind of trick? I asked.
Did he say, "We are the smoke from the cannon's mouth"?
I think so, yes. I remember that.
I was watching his lips. He said something about a golden bowl. He said, "We are the smoke from the cannon's mouth."
Have you heard that before?
Oh, yes. I have, yes. I have heard it on a number of occasions during my boyhood.
Heavy footsteps came toward us from the center of the woods.
"Men from town," I said. "They're coming to burn him out.
About 150 years before this, the same thing happened in Providence."
"Howard Dunstan never lived in Providence."
"One of his ancestors built a place people called the Shunned House. Sylvan Dunstan moved it here, brick by brick." The light separated into three torches advancing through the trees. Cordwainer plunged deeper into the woods. The man in the lead was Carpenter Hatch. Cordwainer let out a howl and charged them. Two of the men dropped their torches and ran. Carpenter Hatch glanced over his shoulder, jumped back, and hurled his torch at Cordwainer. Before Cordwainer snatched it out of the air, Carpenter was already in flight. Cordwainer held his torch over his head and hurtled toward the house. Over his head, leaves sputtered into flame. When I ran out of the woods, Cordwainer was plunging up and down the side of the house, keening.
"Do you know what he did to me?"
"He lied," I said. Cordwainer fell to his knees and unearthed a long, flat, dirt-encrusted rock. The rock sailed like a discus toward the window and smashed through it in a glittering shower of broken glass. With another wide swing, he lobbed the torch through the broken window. Cordwainer took off for the front of the house. The portico light switched on. A bolt slid into its catch with a tremendous metallic clank, and the front door swung open on an empty hallway, leading to a room where flames mounted between piles of books. Cordwainer screamed,
"Where is he?"
"He's going to the attic, where the others are. You must have heard Carpenter and Ellie whispering about them."
Cordwainer turned a furious glare upon me. His strangled voice said,
"An octopus, centipede, spider kind of thing."
We stepped back and looked upward. The attic windows turned soft yellow. What Cordwainer did next astounded me. I needed a second to realize that he was giggling.
"Robert, it's a shame you didn't have the wit, the courtesy to read my stories before destroying them. All is written. We brought each other to this place."
I tried to find Robert, but Robert had departed. I played for time.
"Written? How?"
Cordwainer started laughing.
"I wrote of an other, whose name I knew not. He betrayed me, Robert. You are absolutely wonderfully right."
"So join him. If that's what you wrote, get in there before it's too late," I said.
"How is it possible you don't comprehend? Both of us are meant to join him."
In a repetition of the worst moments from my childhood, a force like a giant hand lifted me off my feet and muscled me in the direction of the open door. Exalted, his feet inches above the ground, Cordwainer sped toward me. I flew back at least 10 feet, the fire seeming to stretch out its arms behind me, before I summoned the strength to resist him. I slammed to a halt at the edge of the portico. The heat curled against my back like a huge animal. Hairs crisped in my nose. I didn't move. Cordwainer howled in frustration. Without Robert, I felt handicapped, doomed. Then a secret door opened in my mind, and from the great, dark, unknown space beyond it, Star Dunstan said, "Back here in the whole world, open up in front of me." In terrified, necessary surrender, I moved into an elemental darkness. I passed through. Forces and powers I had never known I possessed and never wanted to command streamed out from the center of my being and went prowling through Cordwainer's psychic hurricane.
"You must go inside," Cordwainer bellowed. "Don't you understand? Move!"
"It was your story, not mine."
I took a step away from the portico and wrapped him in the terrible glamours I had inherited from Howard Dunstan.
My old enemy, Edward Reinhardt, Mr. X, Cordwainer Hatch, opened his mouth and screamed like a rabbit that had just felt a trap bite into its leg. I felt like screaming, too. Instead, I propelled him howling past me and into our blazing ancestral house. Somewhere within, timbers crashed down. The attic windows flickered red, then an incandescent blue. I moved back from the conflagration and softly, stupidly spoke Robert's name. The fire drowned my voice. Another beam thundered toward the basement. Flames erupting through the roof vanished into the sheet of darkness welling behind them, and I sent myself back to the brazen head. My body shook from the inside out, and the smell of smoke clung to my clothes. I tugged Cordwainer Hatch's Bible out of my pocket. Like my clothes, it stank of destruction. I opened it at random and read the first sentence to meet my eye. It was an octopus, centipede, spider kind of thing, but there was a half-shaped man's face on top of it, and I threw the book on the table. I scrubbed my hands and face, shoved the photographs into their folders, and went down to the lobby. The night clerk pretended not to smirk at my jacket. "Message for you, Mr. Dunstan. Read it to me." Raising his eyebrows, he reached under the desk and unfolded a slip of paper. "Happy birthday. I called Nettie to see if you were there, and she spilled the beans. Want a nice present? Come to my house, Lori." Stuart Hatch's Mercedes 500 SL slanted over the edge of Lori's driveway, with its front wheels on the lawn. I swung around it, trotted to the front door, and let myself in. Posey Fairbrother was holding Tavi in her arms at the bottom of the staircase. Stuart shouted in the kitchen. A plate smashed against the kitchen wall. Tavi began to cry. "Tavi, can you go upstairs with Posey?" His head nodded. Posey folded him into an embrace and moved up the stairs. I walked into the kitchen. Standing at the counter next to the alcove, Lori looked at me and communicated that she was frightened but in charge of herself. Fragments of broken plates covered the floor between her and Stuart. Stuart turned to look over his shoulder. "Get the hell out of my house. Screw my wife. Send me to jail. Is that the deal?" "Are you going to jail, Stuart?" "I hate to say it. I really hate to say it," Stuart said. "But I may be given that delightful honor. Ashton did the impossible. That Kentucky nobody tied me into deals she couldn't have known about." He flattened a hand over his heart. "Did you break into my building, after all? The rules of evidence say that's a no-no." "All secrets come out in the end, even yours. Go home, Stuart." He laughed, making a sound like a crow. "Ha! Tell me about secrets, Dunstan. Do you think I have anything to lose?" He threw a lazy punch at my head. I dodged to the left and hit him in the stomach. Lori yelled, "Stop it!" Stuart staggered back. He shuffled into the counter, fumbled in a drawer, and came out with a paring knife. I was looking for something a little more imposing. "I'm sick of Hatches coming at me with knives," I said. Too angry for common sense, I went straight at him. Stuart jabbed at nothing. I grabbed his wrist, yanked him forward, and kicked him in the ankle. I straddled him and dropped to my knees. I took the paring knife out of his hand. "Don't kill him," Lori said. "Be quiet, please, Lori," I said. I twisted Stuart's right arm behind his back. Stuart kicked the heel of a tasseled loafer into my right shin, and I rammed his arm toward the back of his neck and heard the tearing of ligaments and the loud pop of the ball detaching from his scapula. Stuart groaned and staggered forward.
"You broke his arm."
"Actually, what I did was I pulled his shoulder out of joint. You can drive with your left arm, can't you, Stuart?" I whacked him in the shoulder. Stuart yelped. "I can drive." I pushed him down the counter and told him to open the door. We went out to his Mercedes. Sweating and grimacing, he managed to start the car and rocket it into Blueberry Lane. I took the folders of photographs out of my Taurus. Lori stepped outside and hugged me.
"Thank you for coming. I really am grateful, Ned."
She glanced at the folders under my arm.
"What's that?"
"I'll show you later."
I put the folders on the coffee table and we went into the kitchen. Shaken, Posey came in and began picking up the mess. Cobby finally went to sleep. Is everything all right? Ned was heroic, Laurie said. You should have seen him. Stuart pulled a knife. A paring knife, I said. Even he was embarrassed. When we had bagged all the broken china, Posey blew me a kiss and left the kitchen to go up the stairs. Laurie put an arm around me and we moved into the living room. We settled on the long sofa in front of the coffee table. Laurie looked at me with a contemplative speculation. You said you were sick of hatches coming at you with knives. How many hatches are there, after all? I don't get it, Ned. You're right. I have to explore something with you. You were going to show me those folders? First, you have to hear about the past 2 days. I owe that to you. You introduced me to Hugh Coventry, and you helped me learn about Edward Reinhardt. So I told her. Then I put down the photograph from my third birthday. Here we have baby me. Then I pulled out the image of bow-tied cord-wainer Hatch peering from beneath his bangs. Laurie bent forward. Is that you? It can't be. You weren't even born when this was taken. This is the black sheep of the Hatch family, Stuart's uncle Cordwainer. Stuart knew who I was the second he saw me. Cordwainer was supposed to have died before Stuart was born, so he didn't even know what Cordwainer looked like until he collected the family pictures for the exhibition. He couldn't have missed the resemblance between his uncle and Howard Dunstan. I picked up the studio portrait of Howard Dunstan and placed it beside the other two. Does anything else occur to you? She leaned forward, looked at Howard, then at me. She pushed herself back into the sofa and smiled. I understand why Stuart wanted to squirrel these away. He would not be overjoyed by a blood connection between his family and the Dunstans. Your aunts knew it right from the beginning. But why would he give my aunts a fortune for 3 old houses? Stuart likes being a high and mighty Hatch. He'd have spent a fortune to protect that. Say something about hatches coming at you with knives. In all honesty, Laurie, if I told you everything, you'd either think I was lying or crazy. Laurie was leaning sideways, her chin on her hand. You met your father, this Edward Reinhardt, Cordwainer Hatch, am I right? And he attacked you with a knife. Was it in Buxton Place? And since you are here, he did not manage to do away with you. Should I assume that you did away with him? I said as much as I could. He did away with himself when he found out that he was Howard Dunstan's son. That's all I can tell you. She did not move. Somewhere in or around Edgerton is the dead body of Cordwainer Hatch. Eventually, this body will be discovered. Not long afterward, it'll be identified. That won't happen. Believe me. Ned, everything you say is so vague. Trust me enough to tell me where you went, at least. I'll do better than that. I'll show you. Take my hand. Laurie Hatch grasped my hand, and with the usual sense of dropping through a sudden hole in the earth, I pulled her into what I already knew she would never be able to accept. We came to rest on the corner of Commercial Avenue and Paddle Wheel Road, a short distance from the future offices of C. Clayton Creech. Directly across the avenue, a Model T Ford and a truck with flat sidewalls stood at the curb beside a construction site. Men crawled along the scaffolding and disappeared into the regions behind it. About 10 feet from Laurie and me, the photographer who would freeze this moment watched his composition move into being. Laurie sank to the sidewalk. Where are we? Paddle Wheel Road and Commercial Avenue, in 1929. A row of flashbulbs exploded with a yellow flare and a sharp percussive pop. Laurie jumped. Ned, please, Laurie whispered. The enormous room on Blueberry Lane took shape around us. Laurie reeled around the coffee table and sank to her knees a foot from the sofa. How does your head feel?
Attached.
Laurie hitched forward and fumbled through the old photographs. She pointed to one.
2 minutes ago, we were standing right there.
Any closer, we would have been in it.
I don't understand this, and for sure I don't like it. But you did it. You took me there. That isn't right.
It isn't right or wrong, but you sure could say it's irregular.
Unexpected. Is this something you inherited from Cordwainer Hatch?
from his father.
Ned, I can't deal with any more of this tonight.
I began pushing the photographs into their folders. Whatever you say. After I made it through her door and into the Taurus, I looked at my watch. My 35th birthday had disappeared into history. Officer Truhap monitored my progress around the dead fountain as though waiting for me to bolt. Looks like I have guests.